engulfment and suppression, which I'll put next to another word, repression, with an underlined unequal sign between them, because they denote entirely different things and should not be regarded as synonyms. Mario shifts slightly forward.
Sometimes I get afraid when you forget you have to talk more simply to me.
Well, then I'm both sorry for that and grateful that you can tell me about it. I do forget things, particularly when I'm tired. I forget and just get going. Lining the edges up and folding the little sticky note in half, and then half again, and dropping it into the wastebasket without having to look for where the wastebasket is. Her chair is a fine executive leather swiveling chair, but it shrieks a little when she leans back or forward. Mario can tell she's making herself not look at her watch, which is all right.
Hey, moms?
People, then, who are sad but who can't let themselves feel sad or express it, the sadness, I'm trying rather clunkily to say, these persons may strike someone who's sensitive as somehow just not quite right, not quite there. Blank, distant, muted, distant. Spacey was an American term we grew up with. Wooden, deadened, disconnected, distant. Or they may drink alcohol or take other drugs. The drugs both blunt the real sadness and allow some skewed version of the sadness some sort of expression, like throwing someone through a living room window out into the flower beds she'd so very carefully repaired after the last incident.
Moms, I think I get it.
Is that better then, instead of my maundering on and on? She's risen to pour herself coffee from the last black bit in the glass pot, so her back is almost to him as she stands there at the little sideboard. An old folded pair of USA football pants and a helmet are on top of one of the file cabinets by the flag. Her one memento of Oren, who won't talk to them or contact them in any way. She has an old mug with a cartoon of someone in a dress, small and perspectively distant, in a knee-high field of wheat or rye, that says, "To a woman outstanding in her field." A blue blazer with an ONANTA insignia is hung very neatly and straight on a wooden hanger from the metal tree of the coat rack in the corner. She's always had her coffee out of the outstanding field mug, even in Weston. The mom's hangs up stuff like shirts and blazers, neater and more wrinkle-free than anyone alive. The mug has a hair-thin brown crack down one side, but it's not dirty or stained, and she never gets lipstick on the rim the way other ladies over 50 years old. Pink and cups rims. Mario was involuntarily incontinent up to his early teens. His father, and later Hal, had changed him for years, never once judging or wrinkling their face or acting upset or sad.
But except, hey, moms, I'm still right here.
Avril couldn't change diapers. She'd come to him in tears, he'd been 7, and explained and apologized. She just couldn't handle diapers. She just couldn't deal with them. She'd sobbed and asked him to forgive her and to assure her that he understood it didn't mean she didn't love him to death or find him repellent.
Can you be sensitive to something sad even though the person isn't not himself?
She especially likes to hold the coffee's mug in both hands.
Pardon me? You explained it very well. It helped a lot, except what if it's that they're almost like even more themselves than normal, than they were before. If it's not that he's blank or dead, if he's himself even more than before a sad thing happened, what if that happens and you still think he's sad inside somewhere?
One thing that's happened as she got over 50 is she gets a little red sideways line in the skin between her eyes when she doesn't follow you. Ms. Poutrincourt gets the same little line, and she's 28. I don't follow you. How can someone be too much himself?
I think I wanted to ask you that.
Are we discussing your Uncle Charles?
Hey, moms.
She pretends to knock her forehead at being obtuse. Mario, Levo, are you sad? Are you trying to determine whether I've been sensing that you yourself are sad? Mario's gaze keeps going from Avril to the window behind her. He can activate the Bolix's foot treadle with his hands, if necessary.
The center court's towering lights cast an odd pall up and out into the night. The sky has a wind in it, and dark, thin, high clouds whose movements pattern has a kind of writhing weave. All this is visible out past the faint reflections of the lit room and up, the tennis light's odd small looms, like crisscrossing spots. Though, of course, the sun would leave my sky if I couldn't assume you'd simply come and tell me you were sad. There would be no need for intuition about it. And plus then, to the east, past all the courts, you can see some lights in houses in the Enfield Marine Complex below, and beyond that, Commonwealth's cars, headers, and store lights, and the robed lit lady's downcast-looking statue atop St. Elizabeth's Hospital. Out the right to the north, over lots of different lights, is the red rotating tip of the WYYY transmitter. It spins ring of red reflected in the visible Charles River. The Charles, tumid with rain and snowmelt, illumined in patches by headlights on Memorial and the Staro 500. The river unwinding, swollen and humped, its top a mosaic of oil rainbows and dead branches, gulls asleep or brooding, bobbing, head under wing. The dark had a distanceless shape. The room's ceiling might as well have been clouds. Sk. Boo-boo? Sk. Mario?
Hal?
Were you asleep there, Boo?
I don't think I was. Because I don't want to wake you up if you were. Is it dark or is it me?
The sun won't be up for a while, I don't think.
So it's dark then.
Boo-boo, I just had a wicked awful dream.
You were saying, "Thank you, sir, may I have another," several times.
Sorry, Boo.
Numerous times.
Sorry.
I think I slept right through it.
Jesus, you can hear shocked snoring all the way across. You can feel the snore's vibrations in your midsection.
I slept right through it. I didn't hear you even come in.
Quite a nice surprise to come in and see the good old many-pillowed Mario shape in his rack again. I hope you didn't move the bag back here just because it sounded like I might have been asking you to.
I found somebody with tapes of old psychosis for Until the Return. I need you to show me how to ask somebody I don't know to borrow tapes, if we're both devoted. Hey, Hal.
Boo-boo, I dreamed I was losing my teeth. I dreamed that my teeth dry-rotted somehow into shale and splintered when I ate or spoke, and I was jettisoning fragments all over the place, and there was a long scene where I was pricing dentures.
All last night, people were coming up going, "Where's Hal? Have you seen Hal? What happened with CT and the urine doctor and Hal's urine?" Mom's asked me, "Where's Hal?" and I was surprised at that because of how she makes it a big point never to check up.
Then, without any sort of dream segue, I'm sitting in a cold room, naked as a jaybird, in a flame-retardant chair, and I keep receiving bills in the mail for teeth. A mail carrier keeps knocking on the door and coming in without being invited and presenting me with various bills for teeth.
She wants you to know she trusts you at all times, and you're too trustworthy to worry about or check up on.
Only not for any teeth of mine, Boo. The bills are for somebody else's teeth, not my teeth. And I can't seem to get the mail carrier to acknowledge this, that they're not for my teeth.
I promised Lamont Chu I'd tell him whatever information you told me. He was so concerned.
The bills are in little envelopes with plasticized windows that show the addressee part of the bills. I put them in my lap until the stack gets so big they start to slip off the top and fall to the floor.
Lamont and me had a whole dialogue about his concerns. I like Lamont a lot.
Boo, do you happen to remember S. Johnson?
S. Johnson used to be the mom's dog that passed away.
And you remember how he died then?
Hey, Hal, you remember a period in time back in Weston when we were little that the moms wouldn't go anywhere without S. Johnson? She took him with her to work and had that unique car seat for him when she had the Volvo. Before himself had the accident in the Volvo. The seat was from the Fisher Price Company. We went to himself's opening of Kinds of Light at the Hayden.
320.
They wouldn't let in cigarettes or dogs, and the moms brought S. Johnson in a blind dog's harness collar that went all the way around his chest with the square bar and the leash thing. And the moms wore those sunglasses and looked up and to the right the whole time, so it looked like she was legally blind, so they let S.J. into the Hayden with us, because he had to be there. And how himself just thought it was a good one on the Hayden, he said. I keep thinking about Orrin and how he stood there and lied to her about S. Johnson's map getting eliminated. She was sad. I've been thinking compulsively about Orrin ever since C.T. called us all in. When you think about Orrin, what do you think, Boo? The best was, remember when she had to fly and wouldn't put him in a cagey box and they wouldn't even let a blind dog on the plane? So she'd leave S. Johnson and leave him out, tied to the Volvo, and she'd make Orrin put a phone out there with its antenna up during the day out there by where S. Johnson was tied to the Volvo. And she'd call on the phone and let it ring next to S. Johnson because she said how S. Johnson knew her unique personal ring on the phone and would hear the ring and know that he was thought about and cared about from afar, she said. She was unbent where that dog was concerned, I remember. She bought some kind of esoteric food for it. Remember how often she bathed it? What was it with her and that dog, Boo? And the day we were out rolling balls in the driveway, and Orrin and Marlin were there, and S. Johnson was there, lying there on the driveway, tied to the bumper with the phone right there, and it rang and rang. And Orrin picked it up and barked into it like a dog, and hung it up and turned it off. So she'd think it was S. Johnson. The joke that Orrin thought was such a good one. Jesus, Boo, I don't remember any of that. And he said we'd get Indian rub burns down both arms if we didn't pretend how we didn't know what she was talking about if and when she asked us about the bark on the phone when she got home. The Indian rub burns I remember far too well. We were supposed to shrug and look at her like she was minus cards from her deck or else. Orrin lied with a really pathological intensity growing up, is what I've been remembering. He made us laugh really hard a lot of times, though. I miss him. I don't know whether I miss him or not. I miss family trivia. Do you remember four times he let us sit in on when they played family trivia? You've got a phenomenal memory for this stuff, Boo. You probably think I'm wondering why you don't ask me about the thing with CT and Pemulus and the impromptu urine after the Eschaton debacle, where the urologist took us right down to the administrative loo and was going to watch personally while we filled his cups, like watch it go in, the urine, to make sure it came from us personally. I think I especially have a phenomenal memory for things I remember that I liked. You can ask if you like. Hey, Hal. The key datum is that the ONANTA guy didn't actually extract urine samples from us. We got to hold on to our urine, as the moms no doubt knows quite well, don't kid yourself, from CT. I have a phenomenal memory for things that make me laugh, is what I think it is.
That Pemulus, without self-abasement or concession of anything compromising, got the guy to give us 30 days. The fundraiser, the Whataburger, Thanksgiving break, then Pemulus, Axford and I, pee like racehorses into whatever size receptacles he wants. Is the arrangement we made.
I can hear shocked, you're right. Also the fans.
Boo,
I like the fans sound at night, do you? It's like somebody big, far away, goes like, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. Over and over. From very far away.
Pemulus, the alleged weak-stomached clutch artist? Pemulus showed some serious brass under pressure. Standing there over that urinal. He played the ONANTA man like a fine instrument. I found myself feeling almost proud for him. You might think I'm wondering why you aren't asking me why 30 days, why it was so important to extract 30 days from the blue blazered guy before a GC/MS scan. As in, what is there to be afraid of, you might ask.
How?
Pretty much all I do is love you and be glad I have an excellent brother in every way, Hal.
Jesus, it's like talking to the moms with you sometimes, Boo.
Hey, Hal,
except with you, I can feel you mean it.
You're up on your elbow. You're on your side, facing my way. I can see your shadow.
How does somebody with your kind of Panglossian constitution determine whether you're ever being lied to? I sometimes wonder, Boo-Boo. Like what criteria brought to bear? Intuition? Induction? Reductio? What?
You always get hard to understand when you're up on your side on your elbow like this.
Maybe it just doesn't occur to you, even the possibility. Maybe it's never once struck you that something's being fabricated, misrepresented, skewed, hidden.
Hey, Hal,
and maybe that's the key. Maybe then whatever's said to you is so completely believed by you that, what, it becomes sort of true in transit? Flies through the air toward you and reverses its spin and hits you true? However, mendaciously it comes off the other person's stick? You know, for me, Boo, people seem to lie in different but definite ways, I've found. Maybe I can't change the spin the way you can, and this is all I've been able to do is assemble a kind of field guide to the different kinds of ways.
Some people, from what I've seen, Boo, when they lie, they become very still and centered, and their gaze very concentrated and intense.
The person to whom they're lying. Another type becomes fluttery and insubstantial and punctuates his lie with little self-deprecating motions and sounds, as if credulity were the same as pity. Some bury the lie in so many digressions and asides that they, like, try to slip the lie in there through all the extraneous data like a tiny bug through a window screen.
Except Oren used to end up telling the truth even when he didn't think he was.
Would that were a trait family-wide, Boo.
Maybe if we call him, he'll come to the Whataburger. You can see him if you want to, if you ask. Maybe.
Then there are what I might call your kamikaze-style liars. These will tell you a surreal and fundamentally incredible lie and then pretend a crisis of conscience and retract the original lie and then offer you the lie they really want you to buy instead. So the real lie will appear as some kind of concession, a settlement with truth. That type's mercifully easy to see through.
The merciful type of lie.
Or then the type who sort of over-elaborates on the lie, buttresses it with rococo formations of detail and amendment. And that's how you can always tell. Pemulus was like that, I always thought, till his performance over the urinal.
Rococo's a pretty word.
So now I've established a subtype of the over-elaborator type. This is the liar who used to be an over-elaborator, but has somehow snapped to the fact that rococo elaborations give him away every time. So he changes, and now lies tersely, sparely, seeming somehow bored, like what he's saying is too obviously true to waste time on. I've established that as a sort of subtype.
You sound like you can always tell.
Pamulus could have sold that urologist land in there, Boo. It was an incredibly high-pressure moment. I never thought he had it in him. He was nerveless and stomachless. He projected a kind of weary pragmatism the urologist found impossible to discount. His face was a brass mask. It was almost frightening. I told him I never would have believed he had that kind of performance in him.
Psychosis live on the radio used to read an Eve Arden beauty brochure all the time, where Eve Arden says, "The importance of a mask is to increase your circulation," quote.
The truth is nobody can always tell, Boo. Sometimes they're just too good, too complex and idiosyncratic. Their lies are too close to the truth's heart for you to tell.
I can't ever tell. You wanted to know. You're right, it never crosses my mind. I'm the type that'd buy land, I think.
You remember my hideous phobic thing about monsters as a kid?
Boy, do I ever.
Boo, I think I no longer believe in monsters as faces in the floor, or feral infants, or vampires, or whatever. I think at 17 now, I believe the only real monsters might be the type of liar where there's simply no way to tell. The ones who give nothing away.
But then how do you know they're monsters, then?
That's the monstrosity right there, Boo, I'm starting to think.
Golly, Ned.
That they walk among us, teach our children. Inscrutable. Brass fist.
Can I ask you how it is being in that thing?
Thing?
You know, don't play dumb and embarrass me.
A wheelchair is a thing which, you prefer it or do not prefer. It is no distance. Difference. You are in the chair, even if you do not prefer it. So it is better to prefer, no?
I can't believe I'm drinking. There's all these people in the house. They're always worried they're going to drink. I'm in there for drugs. I've never had more than a beer ever in my life. I only came in here to throw up from getting mugged. Some street guy was offering to be a witness, and he would not leave me alone. I didn't even have any money. I came in here to vomit.
I know what it is you are meaning.
What's your name one more time?
I call myself Remy.
This is a beautiful thing, as Hester would say. I don't feel horrid anymore. Remy, I feel better than I felt in ever, so I don't know how long. This is like Novocaine of the soul. I'm like, why was I spending all that time doing one-handers when this is really what I call feeling better?
As I do not take any drugs. I drink infrequently.
Well, you're making up for lost time, I have to say.
When I drink, I have many drinks. This is how it is for my people.
My mom wouldn't even have it in the house. She said it's what made her father drive into concrete and wipe out his entire family. Which, like, I'm so tired of hearing it. I came in here, what is this place?
It is Ryle's Inman Square Club of Jazz. My wife is dying at home in my native province.
There's this thing in the big book they make us every Sunday. We have to drag ourselves out of bed at the absolute crack of dawn and sit in a circle and read out of it, and half the people can barely even read, and it's excruciating to listen to.
You should make your voice lower, for in the hours of no jazz, they enjoy low voices coming in for quiets.
And there's a thing about a car salesman trying to quit drinking. It's about they call it the insanity of the first one. Drink. He comes in a bar for a sandwich and a glass of milk. Are you hungry?
No.
What am I saying? I don't have any money. I don't even have my purse. This stuff makes you stupid, but it makes you feel quite a bit improved. He wasn't thinking of a drink, and then all of a sudden he thinks of a drink, this guy.
Out of a blue place, in one flashing instant.
Exactly. But the insanity is, after all his time in hospitals and losing his business and his wife because of drinking, he suddenly gets it into his head that one drink won't hurt him if he puts it in a glass of milk.
Crazy in his head.
So when this absolutely reptilian character you saved me from, by sitting down, rolling over, whatever, sorry, when he says, can he buy me a drink, the book flashes in my mind, and for sort of, as it felt like a joke, I ordered Kahlua and milk.
Me? I come in for nights I am tired, after the music has packed away for the quiet. I use the telephone here as well, sometimes.
I mean, even before the mugging, I was walking along soberly, deciding how to kill myself, so it seems a little silly to worry about drinking.
You have a certain expression of resemblance of my wife.
Your wife is dying. Jesus! I'm seeing her laughing, and your wife is dying. I think it's that I haven't felt decent in so freaking long. Do you know what I'm saying? I'm not talking like good. I'm not talking like pleasure. I wouldn't want to go overboard with this thing, but at least at like zero even. What do they call it? Feeling no pain.
I know this meaning. I'm spending a day to find someone I think my friends will kill. All the time I'm awaiting the chance to betray my friends. And I come here and telephone to betray them. And I see this bruised person who strongly resembles my wife, I think. Remy, it is time for many drinks.
Well, I think you're nice. I think you just about saved my life. I've spent like 9 weeks feeling so bad I wanted to just about kill myself, both getting high and not. Dr. Garten never mentioned this. He talked plenty about shock, but he never even freaking mentioned Kahlua and milk.
Catherine, I will tell you a story about feeling so bad and saving a life. I do not know you, but we are drunk together now. And will you hear the story?
It's not about hitting bottom, ingesting any sort of substance and trying to surrender, is it?
My people, we do not hit the bottoms of women. I am, shall we say, Swiss. My legs, they were lost in the teenage years being struck by a train.
That must have smarted.
I would have temptation to say you have no idea, but I am sensing you have an idea of hurting.
You have no idea?
I am in early 20 years without the legs. Many of my friends also, without legs.
Must have been an awful train crash.
Also my own father, dead when his Kinbeck pacemaker came within range of a misdialed number of a cellular phone far away in Trois-Rivières, in a freakish occurrence of tragedy.
My dad emotionally abandoned us and moved to Portland, which is in Oregon, with his therapist.
Also in this time, my Swiss nation, we are a strong people, but not strong as a nation, surrounded by strong nations. There is much hatred of our neighbors, and unfairness.
It all started when my mom found a picture of his therapist in his wallet and goes, "What's that doing in here?"
"It is for me, who I am weak, so painful to be without legs, in the early 20 years. One feels grotesque to people. One's freedom is restricted. I have no chances now for jobs in the mines of Switzerland."
The Swiss have gold mines.
As you say. And much beautiful territory, which the stronger nations at the time of losing my legs committed paper atrocities to my nation's land.
Fucking bastards.
It is a long story to the side of this story, but my part of this Swiss nation is in my time of no legs invaded and despoiled by stronger and evil-hated and neighboring nations who claim, as in the Anschluss of Hitler, that they are friends and are not invading this Swiss but conferring on us gifts of alliance.
Total dicks.
It is to the side, but for my Swiss friends and myself without legs, it is a dark period of injustice and dishonor, and of terrible pain. Some of my friends rolled themselves off to fight against the invasion of paper, but me? I am too painful to care enough to fight. To me, the fight seems without point. Our own Swiss leaders have been subverted to pretend the invasion is alliance. We very few legless young cannot repel an invasion. We cannot even make our government admit that there is an invasion. I am weak and in pain. See, all is pointless. I do not see the meaning of choosing to fight.
You're depressed is what you are.
I see no point and do no work and belong to nothing. I am alone. I think of death. I do nothing but frequently drink, roll around the despoiled countryside, sometimes dodging falling projectiles of invasion, thinking of death, bemoaning the depredation of the Swiss land in great pain. But it is myself I bemoan. I have pain. I have no legs.
I'm identifying every step of the way with you, Raimi. Oh, God, what did I say?
And thus, our Swiss countryside is very hilly. The Fauteuil, it is hard to push up many hills. Then one is braking with all the might to keep from flying out of control on the downhill.
Sometimes it's like that walking, too.
Catherine, I am in English, moribund. I have no legs, no Swiss honor, no leaders who will fight the truth. I am not alive, Catherine. I roll from skiing lodge to tavern, frequently drinking, alone, wishing for my death, locked inside my pain in the heart. I wish for my death, but have not the courage to make actions to cause death. I try to roll over the side of a tall Swiss hill, but cannot bring myself. I curse myself for cowardice, and in Utel. I roll about, hoping to be hit by a vehicle or someone else, but at the last minute rolling out of the path of vehicles on autoroutes, for I am unable to wheel my death. The more pain in myself, the more I am inside the self and cannot wheel my death, I think. I feel I am chained in a cage of the self, from the pain, unable to care or choose anything outside it. Unable to see anything or feel anything outside my pain. The billowing-shaped black sailing wing. I am so totally identifying, it's not even funny. My story, it was, one day at the top of a hill, I had drunkenly labored for many minutes to roll to a crest. And looking out over the downhill slope, I see a small hunched woman. In what I am thinking is a metal art far below at the bottom. Attempting the crossing of the Swiss Provencial autoroute at the bottom. In the middle of the Provencial autoroute, this woman, standing and staring in the terror at one of the 18 long and shiny many-wheeled trucks of our paper invaders, bearing down upon her at high speeds in the hurry to come despoil part of the Swiss land.
Like one of those Swiss metal helmets? Is she scrambling crazily to get out of the way?
She is standing transfixed with horror of the truck, identically as I had been motionless and transfixed by horror inside me, unable to move, like one of the many moose of Switzerland, transfixed by the headlights of one of the many logging trucks of Switzerland. The sunlight is reflecting madly on her metal hat as she is shaking her head in terror. She is clutching her, pardon me, but her female bosom, as if the art of her would explode from the tower.
And you think, oh, fuck me, just great, another horrible thing I'm going to have to stand here and witness and then go feel pain over.
That the great gift of this time, today, at the hilltop above the Provencial autoroute, is I do not think of me. I do not know this woman or love her, but without thinking I release my brake and I am careening down the downhill, almost wipe outing numerous places on the bumps and rocks of the hill's slope. And as we say in Switzerland, I shushed at enough speed to reach my wife and sweep her up into the chair and roll across the Provencial autoroute into the embanking ahead, just ahead of the nose of the truck, which had not slowed.
Hang me upside down and fuck me in both ears. You pulled yourself out of a clinical depression by being a freaking hero.
We rolled and tumbled down the embankment on the autoroute's distant side, causing my chair to tip and injuring a stump of me and knocking away a thick metal hat.
You saved somebody's freaking life, Raimi. I'd give my left nut for a chance to pull myself out of the shadow of the wing that way, Raimi.
You're not seeing this. It was this frozen, whistle terror woman. She saved my life. For this saved my life. This moment broke my moribund chains, Catherine. In one instant, and without thought, I was allowed to choose something as more important than my thinking of my life. There, she allowed this will without thinking. She, with one blow, broke the chains of the cage of pain at my half a body and nation. When I had crawled back to my fauteuil and placed my tipped fauteuil aright, and I was again seated, I realized the pain of inside no longer pained me. I became then adult. I was permitted leaving the pain of my own loss and pain at the top of Switzerland's Mont Papineau.
Because suddenly you gazed at the girl without her metal hat and felt a rush of passion and felt madly in love enough to get married and roll together off into the...
She had no skull, this woman.
Later I am learning she had been among the first Swiss children of southwestern Switzerland to become born without a skull. From the toxicities and association of our enemies' inversion on pepper. Without the confinement of the metal, at the head hung from the shoulders like the half-filled balloon or empty bag. The eyes and oral cavity greatly distended from this hanging, and sounds exiting this cavity were very difficult to listen.
But still, something about her moved you to fall madly in love. Her gratitude and humility and acceptance and that kind of quiet dignity really horribly birth-defected people usually have.
It was not mad. I had already chosen. The unclamping of the brakes of the fauteuil and scooshing to the autoroute, this was the love. I had chosen loving her above my lost legs, and this half a self.
And she looked at your missing limbs and didn't even see them, and chose you right back. Result, passionate love.
There was for this woman in the embanking no possible choosing. Without the containing element, all energies in her were committed to the shaping of the oral cavity in a shape that allowed breathing, which was a task of great enormity. For her head, it had also neither muscles nor nerves. The special art had found itself dented in upon one side, and I had not the ability to shape my wife's head into a shape that I could staff the sack of her head into the height. I chose to carry her over my shoulders in a high-speed rolling to the nearest Swiss hôpital, specializing in deformities of grave nature. It was there I learned of the other troubles.
I think I'd like a couple more Kahlua and milks.
There was the trouble of the digestive tracking. There were seizures also. There were progressive decays of circulation and vessel, which calls itself restenosis. There were the more than standard accepted amounts of eyes and cavities in many different stages of development upon different parts of the body. There were the fugue states and the rages and frequency of coma. She had wandered away from a public institution of Swiss charitable care. Worst for choosing to love was the cerebral and spinal fluids which dribbled at all times from her distending oral cavity.
But your passionate love for each other dried up her cerebrospinal drool and ended the seizures, and there were certain hats. She looked so good in it just about drove you mad with love. Is that it?
Garçon.
Is the madly in love part coming up?
Catherine. I had to believe there was no love without passion. Pleasure. This was part of the pain of the no legs, this fear that for me there would be no passion. The fear of the pain is many times worse than the pain of the pain. Nissa?
Remy, I don't think I'm like thinking this is a feel-better story at all.
I tried to leave the soft-head and cerebrospinally incontinent woman. Me pour sa future behind the hôpital of grave nature and to wheel off into my new life of uncaged acceptance and choice. I would roll into the fraying of battle for my despoiled nation. For now I saw the point not of winning, but of choosing merely to fight. But I had traveled no more than several revolutions of the fauteuil when the old despair of before choosing this no-skull creature rose up once again inside me. Within several revolutions, there was no point again, and no legs, and only fear of the pain that made me not choose. Pain rolled me backwards to this woman, my wife.
You're saying this is love? This isn't love. I'll know when it's love because of the way it'll feel. It won't be about spinal fluid and despair, believe you me, bucko. It'll be about your eyes meet across some place, and both your knees give out, and from that second forward, you know you're not going to be alone and in hell. You're not half the guy I started to think you might have been, Ray.
I had to face I had chosen. My choice, this was love. I had chosen, I think, the way out of the chains of the cage. I needed this woman. Without her to choose over myself, there was only pain and not choosing, rolling drunkenly and making fantasies of death.
This is love? It's like you were chained to her. It's like if you try to get on with your own life, the pain of the clinical depression came back. It's like the clinical depression was a shotgun nudging you down the wedding aisle. Was there a wedding aisle? Could she even get down a wedding aisle?
My wife's wedding helmet was of the finest nickel mined and molded by friends in the nickel mines of southwest Switzerland. Each of us, we were rolled down the aisle in special conveyings, as with special pans and drains for the fluids. It was the happiest day ever for me, since the train. The cleric asked, did I choose this woman? There was a long time of silence. My whole very being came to a knife-like point in that instant, Catherine, my hand holding tenderly the hook of my wife.
Hook? As in hand hook?
I've been knowing since the wedding night her death was coming. A restenosis of the heart, it is irreversible. Now my Gertrude, she has been in a comatose and vegetating state for almost 1 year. This coma has no exit, it is said. The advanced Jorvik 9 exterior artificial art, he said, by the public aid cardiologist to Switzerland to be her chance for life. With it, they say my wife can live for many more years in a comatose and vegetated state.
So you're down here, like, pressing your case to the Jarvik 9 people at Harvard or whatever.
It is for her. I betray my friends and sail the cause of my nation, which now that victory and independence of the neighbors is possible, I am betraying it.
You're spying and betraying Switzerland to try and keep alive somebody with a hook and spinal fluid and no skull and an irreversible coma?
And I thought I was disturbed.
You're making me totally reorient my idea of disturbed, mister.
I'm not telling for disturbing you, poor Catherine. I'm telling of pain and saving a life and love.
Well, Ray, far be it from far from me, but that's not love. That's low self-esteem and self-abuse and settling for less. Choosing a coma over your comrades? Assuming you're even not totally lying to get me into the hay or some fucked up, disturbed, sicko shit like that. Which I've got to tell you, saying I remind you of her isn't exactly the way to sweep me off my feet. You know what I'm saying here?
This is what is hard to tell. To ask any person to see. It is not choice. It is not choosing Gertrude over the AFR, my companions, over the causes. Choosing Gertrude to love as my wife was necessary for the others. These are the choices. Without the choice of her life, there are no other choices. I tried leaving at the commencement. I got only very few revolutions of the fauteuil.
Sounds more like a gun to your head than a choice. If you can't choose the other way, there's no choice.
No, but this choice, Catherine, I made it. It chains me. But the chains are of my choice. The other chains, no. The others were the chains of not choosing.
Do you have a twin that just came in and sat down just to the left of you, but is also like about one-third overlapping on you?
You are merely drunk. This will happen quickly if unused to alcohol. Nausea often accompanies this. Do not be alarmed if there is visual doubling, losing balance, and nausea of the stomach.
The price of, like, complete, normal, human digestive tract.
I used to throw up every morning without drinking. Rain and shine both.
You think there is no love without the pleasure. The no choice compelling of passion.
I appreciate the drinks and all, but I don't think I'm going to, like, memorize a lecture on love from somebody who marries somebody with cerebro fluid spewing out of their mouth. No offense intended.
As you say. My opinions are only that the love you of this country speak of yields none of the pleasure you seek in love. This whole idea of the pleasure and good feelings being what to choose, to give yourself away to, that all choice for you leads there, this pleasure of not choosing.
Don't grudge me a little feeling good of all people, Ray. Asshole. Shit puddle. Swiss head.
Is it better to throw up right away to try to wait before you throw up, Mr. Drinking Expert?
I am thinking that if I were to claim we might leave, and I could lead you only 3 streets from here and show you something with this promise, you would feel more good feeling and pleasure than ever before for you. You will never again feel sorrow or pity or the pain of the chains and cage of never choosing. I am thinking of this offer. You will reply to me what?
I would make the reply that I've heard that one before, asshole, and from guys with a little more to them south of the waist, if you follow.
I do not understand.
What I'd reply is, I'm a shitty lay, as in sex partner. I've only ever been sexual twice, and both times it was awful. And Brad Anderson, when I called and said, why didn't you call again, Brad Anderson, you know what he said? He said I was a lousy lay, and my snatch was sure awful big for somebody with such a little flat ass, Brad Anderson said.
No, no, you are not understanding.
That's just what I said.
You would say no thank you, you are saying. But this is because you would not believe my claim. If my claim it was true, you would say yes, Catherine. No?
Yes? Now you're not on your side anymore, Hal, I can see. When you're on your back, you don't have a shadow. Hey, Hal?
Yes, Mario?
I'm sorry if you're sad, Hal. You seem sad.
I smoke high-res and Bob Hope in secret by myself down in the pump room off the secondary maintenance tunnel. I use Visine and mint toothpaste and shower with Irish Spring to hide it from almost everyone. Only Pemulus knows the true extent. I'm not the one CT and the moms want gone. I'm not the one they suspect. Pemulus publicly dosed his opponent at Port Washington. It was impossible to miss. The kid was a devout Mormon. The dose was impossible to miss. Sales of Visine bottles of pre-adolescent urine during quarterly tests have been noted, it turns out, and classed as a Pemulus production.
Selling Visine bottles?
I'd be immune to expulsion anyway, obviously, as the mom's his relative, but I'm suspected of nothing other than ill-considered moral paralysis out there on I-Day. My urine and Axe Handle's urine are just to establish a context of objectivity for Pemulus's urine. It's Pemulus they want. I'm almost positive they're going to give Pemulus the shoe by the end of the term. I don't know whether Pemulus knows this or not.
Hey, Hal?
Normally they're after steroids, endocrine synthetics, mild dreams when they test. The ONANTA guy gave indications this one'll be a full spectrum scan. Gas chromatography followed by electron bombardment. The spectrometer readings on the resultant mass fragments, the real McCoy, the kind the show uses.
Hey, Hal?
Mike stands there and says, what if hypothetically somebody was downwind from substances and got exposed and so on, claimed vague memories of a poppy seed bagel? Not at all Pemulus's normal rococo type of lie. This one had a kind of weary earnestness. The guy in the blazer said he'd go ahead and give us 30 days before a full spectrum scan. Mike had pointed out that there was an enormous lady from Moment due to arrive and snuffle around, making it a really unfortunate time for any outside chance inadvertent scandals for anybody.
It was like the guy needed hardly any prodding to give us time to clean out the system. O-N-A-N-T-A doesn't want to catch anybody, really.
Good clean fun, and so on and so forth.
The ingenious layer to the lie is that the guy thought the 30 days grace was for Pemulus, that it was what Pemulus needed. Pemulus could pass a urine test hanging upside down in a high wind, guy watching or not. He has a whole unpleasant catheterization technique you don't want to hear about. He's checked it. Antenuates are apparently the indie-type car of dreams, he says. His own urine can be all innocent and pale with 2 days' warning, as long as he stays off the bob. Boo-boo, the 30 days was actually for me, and Mike let me stand there with my unit out and not say anything while he sold the urologist land and magazine subscriptions and Ginsu knives. He did it for me, and I'm not even the one they want.
You can tell me whatever you said.
What I do in secret, Boo. Mike says no more than 30 days to get it all out for sure. Cranberry juice, Cali tea, vinegar and water. Plus or minus a couple days. The Bob Hope I smoke and hide, Boo. It's fat soluble. It stays in there. In the body's fat.
Mrs. Clark told Bridget the human brain is high in fat, Bridget said.
Mario, if I get caught, if I come up dirty urined in front of O-N-A-N-T-A, what could CT do? It's not just that I'd lose my even year in 18s. He'd have to give me the shoe if he'd brought O-N-A-N-T-A into it. And what about himself's memory? I'm directly related to himself, not to mention Orin. And meanwhile, here's this moment lady lumbering around looking for family linen.
Trolt says, all she wants to do is soften Orin's profile.
The hideous thing is how brightly it'd come out if I flunk a urine. ETA will be publicly hurt. Hence himself's memory, hence himself. And it'd kill the moms, Mario. It'd be a terrible kertwang on the moms. Not so much the hope, the secrecy of it, that I hid it from her, that she'll feel I had to hide it from her.
Hey, Hal, something terrible will happen if she finds out I hid it from her. 30 days is one calendar month of Cali tea and juice, you're saying.
Of tea and vinegar and total abstinence, of no substances whatsoever, of abrupt and total withdrawal while I try to justify my seed at the Whataburger and maybe get offered up to Wayne at the fundraiser. And then your birthday in 2 weeks.
Hey, Hal.
Jesus. And then the SATs in December. I'll have to finish prepping for the boards and then take the boards while still in abrupt withdrawal.
You'll get a perfect score. Everybody's betting you get a perfect score. I've heard 'em.
Marvelous. That's just exactly what I need to hear.
Hey, Hal.
And of course you're hurt, Boo, that I've tried to hide all of it from you.
I'm 0% hurt, Hal.
And of course you're wondering why I didn't just tell you, when of course you knew anyway. Knew something. The times hanging upside down in the weight room with the forehead Lyle didn't even want to get near. You sitting there letting me say I was just really, really tired and nightmare-ridden?
I feel like you always tell me the truth. You tell me when it's right to.
Marvelous.
I feel like you're the only one who knows when it's right to tell. I can't know for you, so why should I be hurt?
Be a fucking human being for once, Boo. I room with you and I hid it from you and let you worry and be hurt that I was trying to hide it.
I wasn't hurt. I don't want you to be sad.
You can get hurt and mad at people, Boo. Newsflash at almost fucking 19, kid. It's called being a person. You can get mad at somebody, and it doesn't mean they'll go away. You don't have to put on a mom's act of total trust and forgiveness. One liar's enough.
You're scared your pee might still flunk after one calendar month.
Jesus, it's like talking to a big poster of some smiley-faced guy. Are you in there?
And you can't use a Visine bottle of pee because the man will be right there looking at your penis. And Trevor and Pemulus's penises. The sun's thinking about coming up in the window. You can see it.
It's been like 40 hours without Bob Hope, and already I'm bats inside, and I can't sleep without more of the horror show dreams. I feel like I'm stuck halfway down a chimney.
You beat Ortho, and your toothache's gone.
Pemulus and Accent will say a month will be it. Pemulus's only concern is this DMZ he got for the Whataburger detectable? He goes to the library and pours. He's fully alert and functional.
321.
It seems different with me, Boo. I feel a hole. It's going to be a huge hole in a month. A way more than Hal-sized hole.
So what do you think you should do?
And the hole's going to get a little bigger every day until I fly apart in different directions. I'll fly apart in midair. I'll fly apart in the lung, or at Tucson at 200 degrees in front of all these people who knew himself and think I'm different, whom I've lied to and liked it. It'll all come out anyway, clean pee or no.
Hey, Hal.
And it'll kill her. I know it will. It will kill her dead, Boo-Boo, I'm afraid.
Hey, Hal. What are you going to do? Hal?
Boo-Boo, I'm up on my elbow again. Tell me what you think I should do.
Me tell you?
I'm just too big a prick ears right here, Boo. Listening.
Because I do not know what to do. Hal, if I tell you the truth, will you get mad and tell me to be a fucking?
I trust you. You're smart, Boo.
Then, Hal, tell me what I should do. I think you just did it. What you should do. I think you just did. Do you see what I mean?
The 17th of November, year of the dependent adult undergarment. In Don Gately's medical absence, Jeanette F. had worked 5 straight night shifts on dream duty. I was in the front office just after 08:30, writing up the previous night in the log, trying to think of synonyms for boredom and periodically dipping a finger in her scalding coffee to stay awake, plus listening to distant toilets flush and showers hiss and residents clunking sleepily around in the kitchen and dining room and everything like that, when somebody, all of a sudden, starts knocking at the house's front door, which meant that the person was like a newcomer or stranger, since people in the Ennett House recovery community know that the front door is unlocked at 0800 and always completely open to all but the law as of 0801. The residents these days all know not to answer any knocks at the door themselves. So Jeanette F. at first thought it might be some more of those kind of police that wore suits and ties.
322.
Come to depose more residents as witnesses on the Lentz and Gately and Canadian fuck-up and everything like that. And Jeanette got out the clipboard with the names of all the residents with unresolved legal issues who needed to be put upstairs out of sight before any police were let on the premises. A couple of the residents on the list were in the dining room in full view, eating cereal and smoking. Jeanette carried the clipboard as a kind of emblem of authority as she went to the window by the front door to check out the knocking party and everything like that. But the kid at the door, there was no way he was police or court personnel. And Jeanette opened the unlocked door and let him in, not bothering to explain that nobody had to knock. It was an upscale kid, about Jeanette's own age or slightly less, coughing against the foyer's pall of AM smoke, saying he wanted to speak in comparative private to someone in whatever passed here for authority, he said. This kid, he had the sort of cool aluminum sheen of an upscale kid, a kid with either a weird tan or a weird windburn on top of a tan, and just the whitest Nike high tops Jeanette had ever seen, and ironed jeans, as in with like a crease down the front, and a weird woolly white jacket with ATE in red up one sleeve and in gray up the other, and slicked back dark hair that was wet, as in showered and not oil, and had half frozen, the hair, in the early outside cold and was standing up straight and frozen in front, making his dark face look small. His ears looked inflamed from the cold. Jeanette appraised him coolly, digging at her ear with a pinky. She watched the boy's face as David Crone came scuttling over like a crab and blinked at the boy upside down a few times and scuttled around and up the stairs, his forehead clunking against each stair. It was pretty obvious the boy wasn't any residence like homie or boyfriend come to give somebody a ride to work or like that. The way the boy looked and stood and talked and everything like that radiated high-maintenance upkeep and privilege and schools where nobody carried weapons. Pretty much a whole planet of privilege away from the planet.